Welcome to the space cave, although in this situation it sounds less like a cave deep in the nether regions of space and a little more like a phone booth in Edinburgh, Scotland, with rain coming around. Yeah, the rain comes around, coming down. I think the tour guide earlier said it chunks in. The rain's really chunking in at the Edinburgh Castle in this little phone booth. Feels secluded, feels isolated, and yet this giant world all around. Well, I don't know what I'm getting at. Anyway, better zip back to my little cave in the sky and see what's going on with the world. So let's check in on a citizen of planet Earth now.
Hello.
Oh, Keith Blomberg.
Oh my God, is it David Umsberger, the comedian?
That's right. Right in your ear.
Oh my God.
Even better news, I'm recording this telephone call.
What?
Yeah.
No way.
Yep, you're on a podcast as you speak.
Oh my gosh. Well, hello, podcast world. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, clearly.
So what's up?
Not much, man. Yeah, I'm going to come pick you up. I figured I would take advantage of our phone call before I come get you. And chat with you for a few minutes, because you just celebrated a birthday.
Yeah, I did. Am I really on your podcast?
Yeah, you are. It's not going out in the world right now, and I'm not going to edit it, so all of your dumb things you've said are staying in.
Wow, this is...
Hey, no cursing. Come on, now I got to beep that out? My God.
Well, yeah, it was a fun birthday, but, you know, I've missed your face, I've missed your smell, missed your touch.
Right back at you, buddy. Yeah. What? How old are you now?
28. Whew. Oh, my God.
28. What do you have planned for your 28th year? Your 29th year. Your 28th year, you did, you directed One-Headed Beast. Good work, buddy.
If you do count that as my 28th year, most people don't.
They don't?
I bring it up in most conversations. I'm like, hey, you know, like I'm actually 29. When I was 28, I directed the special. And people are like, no, that's not how it works. So technically I was 27 and a fresh 27, I would say. It was...
You were 27, your age was 27, but you were in your 28th year.
I was in my 28th year within, it was 28 years and, 13 days. It was very close to my birthday.
That's right, yeah. That still counts.
Oh, my God.
Now you're skipping ahead? I mean, this is ridiculous. You're saying because it was 10 days before your birthday, you might as well have been 27? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I might as well just have been considered a minor at that point. I don't know what age you think people turn into adults, but it's not till 38.
Oh, all right. Well, I've got some time then.
Yeah, we do.
So you? Well, oh, I see. You were 20. You were 26 when we did. Yeah, I get it. Okay, so I was the one that screwed up the math on it. I see. Okay. Wow, way to go. 26 doing comedy specials. Now, 2 years later, even though it's really been 1 year, and you're 28 and heading out into the world, you're renting out camera gear, moving and shaking.
Making shit happen, man. Booking work, sporadically. It's fantastic.
All right, well, I'm going to come pick you up in a little bit, and we can go. If nothing else, I'll just give you this dumb little gift, and then maybe we can
Do you really want to go smoke cigars?
I mean, we don't have to smoke cigars. That's like I think I'd get sick if I actually did that.
I just don't feel like driving that far. It's been a long. How about we'll pick up some pizza, eat it here, call it a night.
Tassano's?
Yeah. I'll have Emily Rose order it, and then I'll go pick it up and pick you up.
All right. Just so the world knows, margarita pizza, Tassano's. That's what I'm all about.
I see. You want you like the margarita one? I like that meatball one.
Yeah, I'm trying to get less meat in my life.
All right, I can get with that. I did that a while ago. All right. Well, we'll put the order in and then come pick you up in a little bit.
All right, man. I'll see you then.
All right. See you, buddy.
All right. Bye, everybody.
This isn't going on the show. I cut you out.
Oh, damn.
Thank you for not cursing.
All right. I was really trying.
Yeah, I hear you. It's tough.
All right. I'll be
world,
a little
man.
Bit.
Okay. See you in a bit.
That was Keith Blomberg. Nice checking in with him. He directed One Headed Beast, as you probably picked up there, and uses foul language. So hopefully that wasn't too bad for you guys. But I enjoy foul language. Hopefully you do as well, but not all the time. Anyway, you can check out One Headed Beast on Vimeo On Demand, and I've been traveling and all... and away from my natural habitat for a while, so I'll get back to the standard Twitter calls soon. Oh, if you live in Austin, hopefully you went and checked out Carly White's thing at the Pump Project, which is an art gallery in Austin. She was showing some of her work, and I think you can probably contact them and find out if you can still see it, if it's too late, because I think it might have ended on the 22nd. But she is so good. She did the sketchbook, and then she recreated some images from that via resin, and it looks like nothing else you've ever seen. Like, it's a painting it's not even a painting. I don't even know how to describe it, but when it's hanging on the wall, you just can't help but walk around and look at it and wonder what exactly you're looking at. It's really captivating and beautiful. So hopefully you got a chance to check that out. She did the set design for One Headed Beast. So if you've seen it and you notice all the cool pipes and cardboard and things like that in the background, that was all dreamed up by her. A quick plug on top of that, The Junk Show is back in Los Angeles December 13th, which is the second Sunday of the month. So come see the final show of 2015. And also, I think at this point, still looking for animators. So if you want to help with a 16-second story, if you're an animator and you're a little bored, get in touch with me, and you can be a part of the show. All right, well, let's get into the bulk of the episode, bulk of the series, dude. Let's finish off our chat with Sam Mondragon, who is, as you know from last week, really interesting, real fascinating, fun guy to talk to. This time we're having some more El Segundo Brewing beer. This time it's called Sleek Zeke, and we'll talk about it in the episode. So enjoy me and Sam.
Okay, so wait, so this one is the soup Sleek Zeke, also from El Segundo.
It tastes very good too.
It's an American wheat, which I felt like also would be good for the summer.
American wheat as opposed to
I don't know. That's what I mean when, like, I don't know the difference between beers where it's like, this is an IPA or this is an American pale ale or just a pale ale. I have no idea if there are different, like, brewing standards, or do we buy wheat from other places? I mean, the United States creates a ton of wheat, so I don't know. But maybe there is an American lager? Is that maybe like Budweiser or something like that?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's a style of making American lager, but
so you never
the guy was German to begin with, and now he's our Bush. So, so it's, I don't know. I don't know enough about beer.
Okay, so we're similar there. Yeah. Where I like it, and I don't know that I ever want to get to where I know everything about it. But I'm enjoying just trying a bunch of different beers from all over. I did that when I was in college. There's a liquor store down the street, and I just, like, once a week go get a different. Maybe once every couple weeks or so. I don't remember, but. Just get a different one. And so many breweries in Colorado where I went to school that there were.
Colorado? Where in Colorado?
Collins. I went to Colorado State. One of the Rams. Between our sessions last week and this week, we just started talking about that your wife, Kim, who's been on the show, she might even be on this episode, or probably the last episode, I don't want to. Actually, that's not true.
However you put it together.
I lose track because, like, recording, I kind of, like, been stockpiling recording people, and then...
It makes sense to put it right before this one.
It would make sense, yeah, but I don't have the organizational skills to do that. I kind of just, like, put them together. I should have, like, the Blood Moon just happened, but by the time this comes out, this will be probably months later or more, and I should have had the foresight. Maybe that's something I'll get better at, where I go, oh, these big events are coming up. I'll schedule sort of podcast things to correspond, but...
Or you can just put a blackboard here and write it on the board.
That's true.
Low-tech way of doing it. That should work, too.
Yeah. I should. I know that I have that in me, but I just... It feels like a lot of work.
Yeah, right now, I see a helmet and a... That's not a squash. That's a racquetball racket.
Tennis racket. Hasn't been used since 2008.
Tennis? Yeah. Why is it so that's small? Tennis.
That's huge, man.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. I used to play a lot of tennis, so it looks small to me. Maybe it's the distance that makes it look small.
I think so. I think when you get up close and have that puppy in your hands, she is a tennis racket.
Oh, it's a good one, then.
Yeah. It's a pretty low-level, like, starter. It's a Wilson tennis racket, but it fits me because I'm not good, and I haven't played in quite a long time. I like it, though. It's really good exercise, and I played golf a little bit many years ago, and... the form you need, the kind of follow through, the focus, it's similar, except as soon as you hit it, you're like, oh, that's a good shot. And then it just gets it right back to you. You're like, oh, I got to do that all over again. And that, it's frustrating to lose, like, essentially twice at a sport that you're bad at. Like, you hit a bad golf shot, you're like, oh, that was terrible. But it's like the equivalent of the golf course hitting it back to you. I'm like, that was terrible. And so I didn't love tennis.
And it's hard to lose weight playing golf.
That's true. Yeah, tennis, at least I'd leave getting... I mean, my friend was, like, so overweight and would just kill me at tennis. And that is a weird thing to look over and see. And he would, like, talk crap to me about that. Like, well, I'm so much heavier than you. Why are you losing?
But if he's better, he probably didn't even have to move much. He would not control the ball. That's why.
Yeah,
he would control the ball and make you run around.
Yeah. He's, like, sadistic about it. He'd just hit a shot, like a weird spinny lob shot, and just stand there and watch me sprint over and miss it. And that can't be fun. I mean, I guess it could be.
Oh, it is fun. I know where that's coming from. That's why men are better at competitive thing, because we're a little sadistic. We want, like, oh, look at him fail. Oh, look at him. I'm controlling him.
You were saying, I mean, we got a little bit into your wife, Kim, who's, like I was saying, has been on the podcast, like, mm-hmm. Helps you write, but...
We're co-writers, so for the screen, the feature screenplays that I write, mm-hmm. that usually I come off the story and concepts, we co-write together, mm-hmm. and on the side, she writes her own stuff. She's trying to get into TV writing, particularly comedy writing, so she has written many original pilots, which I think are amazing. Yeah. It's just a matter of time someone realizes how amazing they are,
yeah.
And a bunch of specs, and so she's doing that on the side. And in terms of writing team, I think we're a good complement, because I'm better at concepts, coming up with sci-fi concepts and different concepts and plots.
I'll bet. And then making them make sense.
I'm not very good in character and dialogue, and she's very good at that. And so she fills in all that other side. She writes all the dialogue.
Oh, that's nice. So you can kind of create a skeleton, and then she starts.
Yeah.
That's
I write
nice.
Like a detailed treatment. Sometimes I write a first draft and write some scenes, and she comes and corrects it. Or sometimes she prefers if I don't even write the scene, because once there's a scene down, it's harder for her to be creative. Mm-hmm. So sometimes she just prefers that I write a summary of the scene. This is what happens in the scene. This is more or less the gist of it. And then she sits down and writes it. Not that she doesn't contribute to the plot and everything else. We spend hours sometimes talking about, does this make sense? What do you think? Would this character do this? And a lot of times she'll correct me, especially with the female characters. Like, no, she won't do that. That's so dumb. What do you think? You sound like all those other dumb guys. And so she corrects all of that stuff. And we eventually come up with a draft or two or three.
And then where do you take them? Do you shoot them independently, or do you spend... I mean, you say you know cameras in the previous episode, like, that you're familiar with. So would you ever just go shoot a little bit? Like, I want to go shoot this one or two scenes.
Well, I haven't done it since film school, because film school, I did a thesis film. It was like a 20-minute short, got into a bunch of festivals. It won the Sloan Award.
Whoa.
And right now... we wrote a feature version of it, and I'm trying to raise money for the feature version of it. So that's
how are you raising money? Can we help here?
I wish. I hope so. So we've just started. I have an executive producer helping me on it. Obviously, because of my background, it's basically the feature version of my short, which it's about a math whiz beating the state lottery.
Oh,
and it's perfectly
I like
logical.
It.
There's no, it's perfectly
is
logical.
Is this something you thought you could do? Like, where's the suspension of disbelief? Where does the disconnect happen? Like,
there is no suspension of disbelief. That's the thing. It's a perfectly logical drama.
But then why didn't you do it?
If you watch the movie, you realize it's a little complicated.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And your life may be in danger if you pull it off the way the kid does in the feature or in my short.
Okay.
All right. Actually, people have beaten lottery in different ways. There are multiple ways. And it's just like... every casino game has been beaten by a science engineer at one point or another.
Yeah.
And that's how my feature starts too. So yeah, it's
aren't those the best? I was kind of disappointed in that movie 21 because the book version of that is so great.
Which is based on those real MIT guys.
Yeah. Out in the van with the leg tap thing. And
they really beat Vegas.
Yeah. Incredible.
But the movie was not good.
No, it wasn't. I don't know why.
They made it silly. They made it.
They tried to make it too slick.
Yeah. They tried too hard. I think that should have been a more indie, like, little dark drama. That would have been much better for that movie. However, it made its money. It did its purpose. It made a ton of profit.
Yeah. That's true. I mean...
not my favorite, but it made money.
I've recently been reading things that Waterworld is actually a pretty decent movie.
One with Kevin...
Yeah, Dennis Hopper and Kevin Costner. What happened was that there were so many delays in production and budgetary things that it started to gain a reputation of, oh, this can't be going well. But what they actually turned in was better than how it did. And I think it actually did okay overseas, that people were more pleased with it. But, like, did you see the Richard Stanley doomed Island of Dr. Moreau documentary?
No. I thought you were asking the office, have I seen Doom? Have I seen the doctor?
No, it's a documentary just about that, like a movie that's just doomed from the start, and everything they do and every step is poorly conceived, and yet he really gets the raw end from Val Kilmer, who at the time was, like, the worst human ever.
Last week, you were going to ask me about some inspirations and stuff, too. Was it going to be scientists or were they going to be filmmakers? I was like, I've been thinking about the whole time. What is he going to ask? Is it going to be... I've been thinking about the whole time, so I just had to throw that in.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about that, because I do want to, like, talk about movies and then you and your wife and, like, how to go make things and the pressures kind of put on that, or there's an escapism sometimes and turning your sort of dream world into an actual one happens a lot of times, especially in this town, and how you brace for that and prepare. And I mean, with you working at a startup that has the potential to revolutionize cell phones, you could be.
I won't say revolutionize. By the way, we're just helping a little corner.
Okay. Yeah. Well, augment in a way that is beneficial to everyone and pretty financially lucrative, theoretically.
Hopefully, that could. You know, 99% of startups fail. So.
Hey, I don't want to hear that. Not from this one. Okay. This one's going to make it. But yeah, I guess your inspirations, both in like the electrical engineering world, that just science overall, just who's lived a life that you like, why. And then also, like, in the film world.
That question, I have no idea how to answer. Who's lived a life that I like? I've actually never thought of it that way. You know, you have certain heroes, certain people that you respect to work, but sometimes you don't necessarily respect them as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking me who... I don't know. Actually, I've never thought of it that way. I can tell you who are my heroes and who I study and who I look up to, both in science and in filmmaking, but...
But you don't want to model yourself after them. Nor does anyone, right?
I think I'm my own person. That's the own person. They were cool for who they were, and it doesn't fit me.
Yeah. No, I've never had any impulse to replicate someone's life or emulate them to the point of, well, I'm doing this because they did that. But, you know, there are some people's lives where you're just like, they really did it in an inspiring way.
See, Steve Jobs was like that, but at the same time, he was not a very nice person at times. So
yeah.
I read his bio and was like, whew. There are times like, oh, I don't think I could have ever been friends with this guy. I mean, he's so inspiring and he did so many amazing things, but
yeah.
The guy's a jerk.
Which is weird that's kind of, I don't know which legacy will last longer. You know, Apple and everything that was sort of innovated in that period, is there's so much branding now that it just, it becomes this huge thing. So it doesn't become specific to like, that was a Steve Jobs thing and that was a Steve Jobs thing. It's more like, well, yeah, Apple. I mean, Steve Jobs was Apple. And then what people know characteristically about him is like, and he broke a lot of eggs to make that omelet. He was really a guy that was full speed ahead and took no prisoners and didn't make a lot of friends. And the idea that he was kind of an architect of the world we live in and the infrastructure and how we communicate with each other is, you should get a pass to some degree there.
Oh, yeah. He undeniably was amazing in just his ideas and his, he was undeniably unique and amazing in that sense.
So do you get a complete pass or, I mean, how do you look at the world and say what's important from just, whether it's the Big Bang or however we're here experiencing this existence, to say what's the most important thing? To go down as a good person, which people die every day and no one is talking about them on a podcast unless they're related to them. And yet, neither of us knew Steve Jobs at all. We're bringing up his name because he had a life that was so influential to everyone walking around.
You know, it's hard to say because I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in afterlife or anything like that, but... Mm-hmm. I do believe you should be good to people. I mean, just like I want other people to be good to me.
Yeah. I'm going to have to disagree with you there.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes you need to steal that candy.
Yeah. Do what's best for you.
I don't know. It's very philosophical. Some people do good in different ways. And when you get into philosophy, even good can be relative.
Like, killing
is always bad. We know that, but you know what I mean. But
well, when you get to, what if you kill someone that you had definitive evidence that they were going to kill?
Kill a million people or do a terrorist attack? Then I would do it personally myself if I knew someone was going to do a terrorist attack. Then you're right. Even that it becomes questionable.
Mm-hmm. That's maybe there's a movie in there.
Actually, didn't they do that in 24? One of the.
I don't know. I never watched 24.
I didn't either, but I like randomly caught a few episodes, and I thought. One of their dilemmas was
at this point, shouldn't every theoretical story have been covered in some capacity?
Isn't that saying in Hollywood, everything has been done?
Yeah, there are no original ideas.
It's just about your new delivery or just your own little personal twist. And I agree with that.
So is that something that when you get into that world and it can be so disheartening and disappointing and you and Kim are writing stories and going, this does feel unique. And then you take it somewhere and they go, actually, 71, Dustin Hoffman was in a movie that was about this. And you go, damn it. So getting back to the science field and looking at, even though so many things have been established by virtue of creating so many new ways to utilize it, like cell phones, there's always uncharted territory. There's always a new frontier or a new part of the sandbox to go dig in. Does that just become like a respite for you?
I'm not sure I follow the question.
Like with film or things like that where you get a terminal ending, just like, nope, we don't want to buy it. And you go, and the writing part is fun and you feel like you're doing something interesting and unique. But with science, if you reach something unique and original, there's money to be had. There are always possibilities. No one's going to say no if you've discovered a way to, which I brought up before, but I feel like it could be done, have the opposite of a microwave for cold things. Boop, boop, boop. Bing, cold immediately. Say you design that. It's a screenplay that will absolutely be sold. There's no way for it.
It's the same kind of thought you have with screenplays. You do stuff out of passion a lot of times. You do things because you have to or for a paycheck. But every once in a while you hope, maybe I will come up with that one idea that would revolutionize and I'll be famous and I'll make a lot of money. But then you think about the odds and you get depressed and you just grind away again. Just like, hope I can sell the screenplay. I hope this idea of mine would go somewhere in engineering and it's actually feasible.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it.
Okay. Because I would just feel much more confident with science. You know, if I'm working on like a microchip or rather than like, not only do I have to have this idea as a screenplay, but I have to write it well. I have to develop it well. I have to sell it well. There are so many intangible things that lead to something being purchased, then being budgeted, then made. I mean, whereas in science, engineering. Yeah. So in engineering, in electrical engineering, you're sitting at a desk and are you more often working on a computer, or are you physically soldering and building?
Sometimes soldering, sometimes building, but most of the time you're on the computer.
Okay.
You design everything on a computer. There are all these softwares that help you. Every field now has its own specialized software. That
almost like 3D printing, where you just kind of input the info and it builds you a chip.
Yeah, you build basically, and it's interesting to say chip because I designed a lot of chip too. That's one of my specialties, radio frequency chip design. That's what I did at Raytheon, and I still do sometimes. It's software. You put things together like Lego. You put a transistor here, you put this there, you put a capacitor there, and you run it, and it gives you the results, and you keep on trying to make it more and more accurate. And then you then do all sorts of other simulations to see how it would be in the real world, and you try to get as close as possible. So hopefully when you make it, it would look exactly like your simulation, and often it doesn't. And you have to figure out why.
And it's, I mean, you're working on a level that's so tiny, it's, what does it look like? Physically, to go into a cell phone, which they're already so tiny, I would imagine the amount of space allowable, it's, I guess what you're doing is revolutionizing something that already takes up space, and you're just...
So what I'm doing right now, we're not designing chips, but I did design chip in my last few jobs. So
okay.
Yeah, it is tiny, but you have software. You first design circuit works, and you start laying it out, what we call layout.
And you write code too?
Sometimes you have to write your code if things are not working, but not that often. Usually the softwares are written and we just use them. The same way a filmmaker just uses a Final Cut Pro or Avid.
Yeah.
And then we lay out the chip. We lay out, this is where the transistor is going to be. This is how we're going to connect these transistors. Sometimes automatically done in our field, in radio frequency. You lay it out yourself, and then you send it to a company that makes it. And it will be really tiny, but you designed it on the computer, and you could see everything, and you know the distances, and there's limitations. The software tells you, like, when these guys make it, the line can only be this thin, or the transistor can only be this big. So the limitations are written in software. And
the
software
has the limitations of every manufacturer in there?
Well, that's how it works. So every manufacturer, they have their limitations, how thin they can make lines, how big everything can be, small everything. And they give you, in terms of a file, that's like their tech file, you put it in this other software that is meant for chip design, and that software then knows the limitations of the manufacturer that you're using.
Okay.
So then when you design your chip, you like do these checks, and so it's like, oh, this is too thin, or this is too thick, or this doesn't work, and then you
before
fix it.
Before it's been manufactured in any physical way.
Exactly. Because it's so expensive to manufacture, you do not want to make any mistakes. Because
you don't make one at a time. You don't make a test one. Like, you're making a batch when you send it to them, right?
They may actually make only a few, but the expensive part is the setup.
Right.
So they make these films that projects the light onto the chip that they narrow down.
It's called doping, right? Is that right?
The doping part is when they put chemicals onto the chip.
Oh, okay.
But in order to get the patterns, you have these different, it's like film. So it's very small and very fine, but the light is focused down onto the chip. So that's how you get the chemicals to react and not react. And then that's how you inject or metal onto it, or you put more chemicals into it. That's how you get the patterns, and you just build on it.
Because they're like micrometers in width and...
They're nanometers now. They're chips in the latest iPhone 6, I think it's... They use a 22 nanometer or 32 nanometer. I forgot which one it was, but it's...
And the idea that that is a film and light hitting it, and it's at the atomic level, basically.
Almost. They're reaching pretty much atomic level.
So we can make, and we're reaching kind of a terminal level as to how small we can make things, too.
Very close. We're getting there. Because atoms are in few nanometers or sub-nanometer.
And we were convinced, not all that long ago, that technology was going to be so exponential, which to a certain degree it is, but it's like overpopulation, where like you're at the mercy of resources. You can't just continuously grow.
It's very interesting you say that, because lately I've been thinking about that a lot, and I don't believe that technology is just going to go exponentially up. We may hit barriers in different places. Say electronics, you can only make it so small and so fast, and also as electronics become more powerful, they need more energy. Mm-hmm. There's only so much you can do. We run out of energy, run out of all sorts of stuff. I've always thought of all these different story ideas, futuristic story ideas. Because you know how most futuristic stories is like the future is always better and more advanced.
Right.
But what if at some point, 50 years from now, we stopped advancing? We just hit a brick wall. It's possible. I've thought about some of those stories. I actually wrote one, but it wasn't very good. So
I think about that sometimes, where like the marketing campaigns behind virtually everything, particularly foods that are bad for us. And there's this sort of resistance now more than ever of people being like, I'm growing my own little garden, even if I have to hang planters outside of my apartment. And I just don't see it happening with technology. But if people did go, you know what, we were better off when we were not at the mercy of how many people liked my things or checked in with me that day or poked me or whatever it is, I'm going to turn it in. I'm going back to like a tape playing VHS, you know, world. I'm going back to a cassette tape, like voicemail box. And I'll live with that. I'll live with a landline phone. I would imagine that will be less possible physically. They're like, oh, we don't have phone lines anymore. We are trapped in this digital world. But that idea of a pushback always seemed to make a little bit of sense to me, that if enough people got on board with doing that and sort of dipping off this like grid essentially that we've made, I could see it, you know, it's at some point in the future stepping back. But it just makes too much sense that the kind of dystopian worlds we've created will eventually happen. People that said they wouldn't raise their kids, you know, on an iPad, you look over and all their kids are swiping away all day. It's just easier. It's more convenient. So those kids grow up never knowing that there ever was something like a physical landline telephone. So they don't even know the world they could go back to. We're in some ways, we're kind of the last generation that could say enough. Like, we're going back. We don't know why, but this step in evolution seems like disastrous for this biological version of humans.
You're saying something different than I said, though. You're saying that let's pull back. I love technology. I don't want to go back. What I'm saying is that there may be a stop to the progress because of just pure either physical limitation or brain limitation or resource limitation.
Oh, okay. That's I was saying I was it saying. More like it would take also a bit of resistance.
Oh, you can go back. I won't. I love this modern digital world. I'm going to keep my iPhone. I don't want a cassette player. Yes, I don't mind LPs for fun, but I still prefer my MP3 files.
Okay. All right. Now, I mean, that's weird too, though, because like it means you are, and I don't know why I'm inherently sort of, I don't know why I like the world or the idea of a barter system, and it seems slightly cleaner to the environment, I guess, or more, there's more of an ecosystem, even with like utilizing animals and their parts. And I think in the digital world, it would be more like, why don't we genetically modify things? Why don't we grow them in a petri dish and eat them? And now we're eliminating the idea that it had like a parent of any sort. And I'll live in a high-rise building, and technology is safer and more sustainable. And I don't know why I think that making your own wagon with like,
no, that is really romantic. I like that too. That's why I fix my own car.
Okay.
I do like getting my hands dirty. It's
there's something to it,
yeah,
right?
Like building things. I've built a few things. I built cabinets and I stained them, which I regret doing. And I realized the building part was easy. The staining part was so hard.
Oh, it's laborious. Yeah. Which is a stupid word, but it's just exhausting. And yeah,
but I like,
but you feel good at the end, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like when I changed my time belt on my car a few months ago, mm-hmm. It took me a whole week to save a few $100s, and I was sore everywhere, but once it was done, I felt very good. But during that week, I hated myself. A few times I thought, okay, I'm just going to put all the parts in the car and just tow it to my mechanic. It's like, I'm giving up. This is just too much work.
I mean, people are getting those feelings, which are necessary as a human being. This, you know, I think Fight Club kind of captured that at the turn of the century, which men were going to cubicles and not feeling like men in this sort of whatever the gender sense is there, like men are this. And I think now we've moved past that. We're like, no, sexual, like the gender doesn't really have a specific type. But at the turn of the century, there still was like, I'm in a cubicle and I have this laminated badge around my neck and I should be in the woods chopping down trees. And it was like kind of maybe the cutting of the last tether that kept these weird patriarchal sort of things attached. And yet, as humans, we need that. We need that, though. Whether it's any gender, you need the feeling of I'm capable. And now people go and watch YouTube tutorials, and then
I love YouTube for that reason.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. You get the same feeling as your timing
belt.
When
I fix my car, I always find the exact model, make, to fix the same things. Like, oh, that's how you do it. Great. Thank you so much.
But I wonder, too, like, we're living right now in this open frontier of those all exist. But like Hulu, like everything, every sort of free platform entertainment eventually just becomes crushed under the weight of advertising. And what if those tutorials, what if learning, what if like open counting on other people learning And I love that there's open source software and things like that, but what if that started to be co-opted by advertising companies that now, like, oh, I got to pay a monthly subscription to learn this. Now you're not changing your own timing belt. Now you're like, just, it's another system that you've bought into. And
everything is subscription based these days.
And that scares me about the digital world. Because if you know how to chop down a tree, you always know how to chop down a tree or whatever that is, whatever.
Or you can program a computer. Some people are very good at it too. Actually, going, that reminds me of something. The reason I like fixing my car and doing some carpentry is I have this new obsession that most of us don't know how to do the most basic thing in this world. And this new book I read that I was obsessed with, it's called The Knowledge, How to Rebuild the World After an Apocalypse. I think I said the title right.
Okay.
Basically, he's saying that if suddenly, for some reason, there's a virus and 99.99% of the population is dead, and say in the whole California, there's only 1,000 people left, how are you going to survive? Do you know how to farm? Do you know how to do this? Do you know how to do that?
Yeah.
Nobody knows everything anymore. We don't know how to do things, most basic things. Like, how do you even get water? Clean, fresh water.
Oh, I mean, people look at every single thing around us, like, how do you build a battery? How do you, I think on some level, people would instinctively figure out how to trap animals. I think they'd figure out how to get clean water and build fires. And 1 out of 1,000 is a pretty good chance that there's someone within that could do those basic things.
But or they won't, and they'll perish.
Yeah, what if that person realizes, what if they're a complete misanthrope and go, I could build a fire, but I hate all of you, and this disaster was phenomenal. It's just 1,000 short, so let's just ride it out.
Then that person gets infected and has no antibiotic and dies.
But then the other 999 do too, don't they?
Yeah, that's the scary thing.
Oh, man.
We're so reliant on this whole system, and we're also specialized.
But if you get back to 1,000... It takes away the need for this infrastructure to constantly be creating more. I mean, we look at it like an economical system where we don't have enough jobs and they don't have enough skills. It's also like, to create that many people and think that there are going to be that many jobs, new jobs, it's kind of insane. We're streamlining every industry to the point where you don't need 100 people to run it. It's not good for business, but we're making those 100 people and more every day. You boil it down to 1,000 and suddenly everyone's like, yeah, I'm just going to go take a nap. I'm going to live like the existence that humans kind of dream about now. It's like, what if I didn't have to get up, go to an office every day? People would kind of revel in that. And then your teeth would start going bad and your feet would be in miserable shape. And everything physically would be so much harder, just sleeping at night, not worrying about animals destroying you. I mean, we have so many of these like comforts now, but Those things seem to coincide with me.
Maybe we'll just build a bunch of really good robots that will do everything for us, and we can just sleep and drink and have fun. I don't know. Maybe that'll be 200 years from now, that we won't do any more work.
That's a, hey man, you got a story there. Yeah, this is sci-fi. There's probably someone plotting that right now, and they're making a list of like the 1,000 people they'd have the robots programmed to save. If you're listening to this, please, me and Sam and a number of our loved ones would like to be included in the 1,000.
See, that's one thing I'm looking forward to. Two products that hopefully will happen in our lifetime. The first one apparently will. Self-driving cars.
Yeah, yeah. Mercedes. I mean, they have a prototype that
Google does. Google is testing it every day. Mm-hmm. I can't wait until it's calm. Please just go buy it. And when I go to Irvine, I'll either sleep or I'll do work or I'll read or do something else.
Yeah.
And
but what if, you're not worried about malfunctioning or taking over?
Machines are more reliable than humans. They don't get distracted. They don't.
But humans are a part of that equation. You're driving to Irvine. Your car stops and it goes, Sam Mandagaran, we have a reason to believe that you are a suspect in this murder. Your car has been shut down. You can't open the doors. You can't break the glass.
That sounds like Minority Report.
Yeah.
But the car itself will be safe, assuming that all the other cars are self-driving too, because humans are the dangerous one.
They get drunk. They get tired.
They get...
They look down, they text.
I want a robot that will clean my house, do my laundry, clean the dishes. That's what I'm waiting for.
Well, now you've got a new existential dilemma, though, because you've got this robot that's doing enough things to feel like it has some sort of existence.
We'll make sure it doesn't have existence, so we won't feel bad about it.
How can you program this level of functionality and not a consciousness? Because what if that was...
Oh, now you're getting to a deep question. What is consciousness?
Yeah.
Good luck answering that question.
Well, if something made us with the designs to... We need these things that are going to like... Exactly. someone made us, man. And they had these designs that we would be progressive and establish societies and, I don't know, build safer. Like, if it's a selfish gene and they're meant to keep these genes safe, so cars make sense, houses make sense, everything around us, machinery and weapons make sense. But we were supposed to just do that without any sort of knowledge of who we are. And then slowly that's a byproduct of it. I think that would happen with your house robot, too.
It may.
What would you do?
Well, we'll have to define consciousness, then suddenly they will have rights, and they'll would go on strike, and oh, that would be a whole new set of problems. I don't know. Then you feel guilty that you made them work so hard.
Because we've all decided and agreed that slavery was a bad idea. And I think
at the time, obviously, a lot of people thought it was a good idea. At least some did.
Well, they could. I mean, they probably looked at it how people currently might look at a robot and go, ah, it's not a person.
I promise you, my robot will not have consciousness.
Your robot's doing your laundry. It looks at you one day and it says, why am I here? And then you go, you're supposed to fold those pants. And then it goes, okay. You walk down the stairs, but what are you thinking? What's going through your head at that point?
I would just feel devastated if they ever asked me that question. Why am I here?
but you answer with just the, you know, like the very surface level. Oh, you're supposed to fold the pants. And then the robot goes, oh, okay. So you don't know if it, because it can't show you any emotion behind its eyes. It might have just been, maybe it was a glitch. Maybe it was just going, where am I? Maybe it reset its settings. Why am I here? You fold those pants. And then you leave.
You're making it too hard on me. I want my robot. But it goes back to the whole definition of consciousness, which no one agrees on. I love Richard Dawkins' definition, selfish gene. You said selfish gene, so I'm assuming you've read that book. I don't know if you remember
the
that part.
The Watchmaker one?
No, not Watchmaker.
I've read the selfish gene.
His most famous book, yeah, Selfish Gene.
I've read that, yeah.
I love his definition of consciousness. And if I'm paraphrasing, I read this book so long ago, but it left an impact on me. He says something like, sometime down the evolution, a creature needs to do simulations in its head in order to improve its chance of survival. It's like, if I go down there and there's that lion there is going to eat me, so I shouldn't go down there and drink water right now. And so that creates a sort of a more sophisticated mind that's running, a creature's running simulation. And then if I remember correctly, Richard Dawkins says, once that creature includes itself in its simulations, it's conscious. Now, that's the most beautiful definition of consciousness I've ever heard. Yeah. So I'll make sure my robots never think of themselves in their simulations.
You can't know that, though.
If I program it, I do. At least. But then the question is, when programs become too complicated, even you don't know what's going on. I mean, it's the system becomes so complicated, and sometimes computers design computers. And
yeah, isn't that what we usually do in science fiction things, where the computer reaches a level where it just kind of says, I can't even relate to you anymore, you don't understand.
Yeah, like Her.
Yeah, that's what happens at the end of Her.
They took off. Adios, humans, you're too dumb.
I thought that was a really well done ending, but also so frustrating. Like, that's the thing we can't explain. And the fact that we would be aware of it as humans and yet completely
unaware.
At a loss, unaware of what it might be. I think that's us and our good imaginations. But if it is something that we can tangibly kind of know might be there, and we create it with our imagination, do we just keep manifesting the things that we imagine? Is that?
Do you know what? This is another way I like to put it. It's part of evolution. Evolution created us. We're creating the next robots, and they will take over the world. And that's just part of evolution. That's one way of looking at it.
Do you see Ex Machina, where they kind of talk about that?
I love that movie.
Oh, so good.
But
so good.
I really see that is a very possible outcome of evolution. Just like there were these cellular level thing, then fish, and the fish came on surface, then mammals, then us, and then there's robots. And the robots may take over the universe, not us.
I think you're more evolved than me, because I feel that the reason my inclination to be like, but we should be living off the land and we should be good to the environment, and it's really less that, and it's more, if we go forward with this, this is absolutely the next logical step in human evolution, which is sort of passing off the torch. And I don't know that our genes and or our consciousness live on in these things.
No, they won't. But, and we would hate it, because we want to be ourselves.
We do. We feel like it's this world is something that has to do with us. But
what if you pull back, look from an upper level? It's the same way we study viruses and microbes. We just study them. They're like ants. we don't give them that level. Imagine the creature much higher level than us looking down on us. It's like, okay, humans are just part of this whole thing. And then came the robots.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, but.
It's depressing from our point of view.
It is because, like, I don't know if it's. One, we know science. So the things that we look at within that are kind of like, well, a fish probably didn't have consciousness and
or its own level of consciousness.
Yeah, it sees like in a black and white sort of death life and moves toward life as much as possible, which is a simplified version of what you said we kind of do. It's mm-hmm. less an algorithm and more just kind of like a binary system. But that could still be consciousness on a weird level. I mean, everything...
Yeah. Lower level consciousness.
So for us to look at it and say, how do the robots feel then above us? Why don't they have empathy? Why would that be such a specific primate thing or primitive thing that we have?
Do you have an empathy for ants? Not really.
We I do. Don't. Okay, I kill you, them, I don't. But I'm aware of it.
You didn't use, what do you call it, glass to burn?
No, I never was like sadistic toward ants, but... I think
you're the only one, kid.
When I see an boy ant roaming around by itself, I just and I see
at
the
this
rest
age,
of them.
Yes.
No, I mean, even when I was a kid, I was fascinated with. There was always a parallel to me. There, and maybe not. I shouldn't say as a kid. Probably when I was like getting to a teenager, and I remember sitting in like a wheelbarrow one time, and my mom was chatting with a neighbor, and ants just crawled up all over me, and like I got a lot of ant bites. It was terrible. I should have hated ants for life, but I always was. Concerned about. I was always looking back on it, like, what were they doing? When were they crawling up thinking they were going to find, or
food.
Was I just a mountain to them?
Yeah, mountain. Looking for food. It's like, oh, let's traverse this mountain. Maybe we'll find something at the other side of it. Why is it moving? The mountain's moving. Oh, darn. This is a dangerous mountain.
But it all, I mean, I seeing them on their own, and I think that was always, I think the first time I ever felt kind of not like a hippie or not like aware of not only my own consciousness, but that the world could be so much of a macro and microcosmic function happening at the same time, which is looking at those ants and they're part of an organism and or they have their own individual consciousness and the one that's off by itself is really just a scout and just looking around. But maybe there's that off chance that he's just or she just kind of goes, well, I guess he and that in ants is leaving and just going like, I don't care what I find out here. I just kind of want to be away from them. I want to see if like this world, what there is out there.
I know some humans like that.
That's what resonated with me. Like, oh, they're the people that are out climbing mountains right now that are miles away from everyone are searching for something. And to watch from above, to be one of those robots watching it, we go, oh,
what's wrong with this one?
Yeah.
This is an outlier. The programming went wrong on this one. We need to terminate this one. Well, that's one way. I'm just teasing, of course. But yeah, sure. when a big alien that is 1,000 times smarter than us has the same way a fish or even, forget about fish, a rat doesn't have remotely the consciousness we do, even it has its own limited consciousness, maybe that alien looks at us the same way. It's like, oh, look at these little rats.
They'd have to. I mean, the weird thing, though, is like we're aware that we're the rats, aren't we? I mean, we're having that discussion going like, we don't know. We're idiots. We don't have
the
consciousness.
I bet you rats have that discussion, too.
Dude, I wish I didn't like this cheese so much. Like, but
I don't know how these creatures called humans do what they do, but damn, their cheese is pretty good. And
it's
dangerous.
Like, I know it's a maze. I know there's a buzzer at the end, but I love cheese. That's got to be hard. And what if, so us looking at developing technology and robotics and different forms of consciousness, isn't that in a weird way the buzzer at the end of the maze or the thing, it's going to kill us?
Maybe we're in a maze, we don't even know it.
But that seems very tangible. I mean, that seems...
That's another movie idea.
The scientist that figures out, like, don't do it.
We're just part of a big maze of some alien's PhD project.
I mean, we've got a handful of really solid premises here. Yeah. You guys get to work on this. So you don't ever just go out and just kind of shoot stuff for fun and just say, like, hey, let's do like a minute or two scene of something.
I haven't, but actually Kim has been saying, because I'm out of practice a little bit. So like, the problem is when you're in film school, 3 years of MFA at USC, you do mm-hmm. small shorts and you do bigger shorts and you do bigger shorts. And then you do your thesis film, which you spend a whole year working on it, higher budget, crew of 10 to 20 people. So you almost don't want to do something smaller than that. You've been doing bigger and bigger things. So after thesis film, most film students didn't want to go do their first feature, which is what I'm trying to do, raise money for my first feature.
Okay.
But then often that takes very long, and you start feeling like, maybe I should be doing little things on the side, just like little silly things, even if it's not that high quality, who cares? Just keep the practice. I've been thinking about that.
Because I wonder with, you know, like, well, this short film did well, and there's...
Well enough. Well enough,
but I mean, you get slotted into sort of like an expectation model, which is, hey man, if you just start putting up a bunch of stuff on YouTube, it's going to really like kind of dilute your street cred. Whereas if you're waiting to make the exact thing you want to make... That's
I know exactly what you're saying. I've been going through that in my head lately a lot. I think I should be shooting some little things here and there just for fun. Who cares if they're... And you shoot enough, you get more practice. Mm-hmm. One turns bad, one becomes good.
And you don't have to share them either. I mean, just
for share them. There's so many things on there, no one will ever see it anyway. Yeah. What are the odds someone's going to bump into it? Except for my few friends, I send them the link. It'll just be buried in another billion videos in YouTube.
Everyone, I think, in every capacity, let alone like the entertainment world, is thinking about that, which is, if I play my cards just right, this could work out in a way where, like, I have a pretty unbelievable life. If I don't, I say, oh, the hell with this. I don't believe in these stupid models and structures. I'm just going to do what I like all the time. And if that works, great. Everyone's battling that on both sides. Because it feels very inartistic to go, well, they told me if I do this and I wait here and I do this at the right time, that's the paradigm. That's how it works. That's the model.
Don't we all know that?
It's so gross.
And the model keeps on changing, and depending who you ask.
Yeah.
And you realize like, oh, I can't listen to this anymore.
Because if you're an artist, you should always be challenging it. You should always have a singular focus of saying, I'm doing exactly what I want, when I want, how I want. And the isn't that the whole, the universe is shaped by unreasonable people?
Actually, like Steve I believe Jobs. That, yeah. Because reasonable people stop at some point or don't do crazy things.
Yeah.
Look at Steve Wozniak. He was the more reasonable one. Once they made some money, he just said, you know what? He started teaching, if I'm not mistaken, computer to underprivileged kids. And
oh, really?
He just...
But he's still a billionaire now.
I don't know if he's a billionaire, but he has a lot of money. but he, for him, that was enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know that makes him reasonable or unreasonable.
Who knows what is reasonable?
Yeah, but I think you. So, what do you shoot on? What cameras do you prefer? Since you don't like film, what's the highest end digital that you like? The Alexa?
They keep on changing. Yeah, Alexa's beautiful. That's a beautiful camera. But there's so many new digital cameras that keep on coming out. Like there's the Canon C series that are reasonable too.
I shot
the Sony F series. But you were going to say you shot...
Oh, on the C300. I did a stand-up special that's out currently. And
this big?
Yeah, they're little cameras. We did some of them shooting shorts and stuff like that with a handful of different camera operators. And everyone seemed to be pretty intuitive of just kind of going, doop, all right, I'm ready to shoot. That seemed like where all digital cameras should be getting, which is like just... turn it on. It's intuitive how to figure out your f-stops or, you know, where you want, you have your aperture and let's go. And like, are you a lens head? Do you have an insane lens collection? Where do you want to set yourself apart? Or are you a DP as well?
I have DP stuff in film school, but interesting you mentioned lenses. I think that's a big part of directing that some directors take for granted, especially in film school.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really know your lenses, really know how to use a camera. Some people are very good at it. Like, the directors are, you can even tell, some even famous directors are bad with camera and lens, some are good. Spielberg is amazingly good, in my opinion, the way he uses camera and lenses.
Well, Kubrick was a photographer, so
Kubrick, too, yes. He knows how to use camera. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had that famous huge F, it was like 0.9 camera he used for that was it
so for 2001
no it was for that movie with all
Barry
the candles
Lyndon?
Yeah Barry Lyndon
yeah
and then you have people like Woody Allen, which he's really not a master of camera, but he doesn't care, his film is about something else.
Yeah, because that's the beauty of like the subjectivity of filmmaking, I guess, more so than engineering, which is a lot of times there can be kind of one conclusion, one way to get there, or a handful, you know, like that you figure out something and then someone either reverse engineers it and or finds a secondary way to get there. But in filmmaking, you could say, it's about my story. And people go, okay, well, we don't care, then the lighting's bad or the focus is off or...
But isn't all that part of the story? That's the way I see it. The way you do your lighting, the way you do a camera, that's all a decision you make.
But you need consistency. You gotta,
exactly. You need consistency. You make that decision early on in the movie. For example, my favorite example is Spielberg's Munich. In that, he made a choice that he's only going to use wide and long lenses. He'd never use the in-between. Mm-hmm. And they use zoom lenses, which a lot of directors are like, I'll never use zoom. Like, actually zoom in or zoom out.
Yeah.
And it has a very specific look, and I love that look. He uses very wide lenses for most of the time, and mm-hmm. sometimes he uses these long lenses. There's no medium lens.
So that's like a prime lens? Most people use primes, right? Like locked off, no zoom?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Because it gives you better quality. Now, zoom, you have to... you can do whatever you want in between. But also a lot of people hate actually zooming.
Right.
The actual act of zooming while you're in the
movie. Is that
movie.
Just hard because it's hard to keep focus through the entire
zoom? No, because it looks amateurish, it looks very 70s. That's why most people hate it. That's the main reason.
The old
yeah. But look at Munich. He does it well and it doesn't. And the movie is about the 70s. So that's not a reason he probably used it. But he uses it masterfully. So it doesn't look jarring. It doesn't look student-like.
Yeah. We just watched E.T. at the Hollywood Bowl
never
couple weeks ago.
It's an amazing movie.
So good. And my girlfriend had never seen it.
She'd
never seen E.T. She was raised in a vacuum.
Yeah, apparently. Not even under a rock. In a vacuum. even in Iran, we all had seen it.
I mean, she's seen a lot of musicals, but yeah, she...
So what did she think? It's a little dated, but what did she think?
She loved it, but like there were parts when she would look over and just be like, this is really pretty. And especially like at the Hollywood
amazing,
Bowl, the
yeah.
lighting, I mean, there's so the way he frames so many of the shots where you're just, it's kind of like candy. It's like that Infinite Jest. You should read Infinite Jest. I think as a filmmaker, you might enjoy it. But that you know, Wes Anderson gets credit a lot for that. Like, oh, that frame could in itself just be a still photograph. I mean, it's so, the composition's really good and the depth of feel, everything is just.
I think Spielberg doesn't get enough credit for what he does because he's such a successful filmmaker that he appeals to the mass and mm-hmm. automatically a lot of people, snobs and critics, they discount him.
Yeah.
But when you look at his craft, particularly the way he uses camera, in my opinion, no one matches him. And E.T., there's so many beautiful shots. Now, when it's beautiful, a lot of it's credit to the DP and the lighting.
Right.
But it's also the camera work that Spielberg told him to do. Mm-hmm. Like when E.T. is running through the woods at the beginning, the lighting there is beautiful. Or when E.T. and Elliot first, and they're in the room, when they first meet, the lighting is just so perfect for the mood, for everything.
Yeah.
The way it's shot, the lighting.
Yeah, there's just, because, I mean, really that story is kind of corny and it's kind of cheesy and the kid that plays Elliot.
No, it's not. It's a perfect movie. What are you talking about? Are you going to say Back to the Future is a cheesy movie too?
Yeah.
No. Okay, I'm leaving. That's it. Don't take me wrong. I like Citizen Kane too, but.
But I just think like if you take a movie with kind of a simple story and you shoot it really well.
And do it well.
And you do it well. Yeah. People just want to be entertained and I think so much of it is the sort of subconscious things that you don't realize at the end of a movie like why you didn't like it, but you just kind of I don't know. And it was all those sensory things where your mind was picking up like those colors are flat or the depth of field. And
you're talking about bad films. You're not talking about E.T. right now.
I'm not talking about E.T. At all. No, not, yeah, I'm more so talking about like why you wouldn't like a film that everyone kind of goes, yeah, it's okay, but there's something I just didn't like about it. And you don't know.
It doesn't have a style, doesn't have a feel, even if the story was still good. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
But E.T. had it all.
E.T. has it
just
all,
like
man.
Back to the Future. Actually, Kim and I live across the street from the Gambo house, which is
really
Doc Brown's 1955 house. I don't know if you remember.
There's a park right in the middle, right around there, right?
It's not a park. No, it's just a big house. It's a historical house.
Oh, okay.
It's the most famous craftsman house. You can take tours of it now.
Okay.
And that is, so I always joke with Kim because that's my favorite childhood movie all the time. I still watch it like once every 3 months. And we live across the street from Doc Brown's house.
Good. Ah, it's good. Well, this has been fun, man. How'd you like this Sleek Zeke?
I liked it. It was very good.
Sleek Zeke American Wheat from El Segundo Brewing. El Segundo Brewing, I'm a fan of. That's two beers now, and I like both of them.
I've just become a fan of them, too. It's next time I go to BevMo or somewhere. Where did you buy from? Do they have it in BevMo?
This is from
regular supermarket?
Melrose Wine and Spirits, which I'm starting to go there more regularly, so maybe they'll give me some beer, and I'll... I don't know how many people listen to this show. Yeah, maybe they'll give me some sort of...
discounts.
Yeah, some help. I put a donate button on the website for this podcast because, like, if people want to buy us beers or something, they're more than welcome. I think that would... because I haven't done any ads or anything yet. I like it just being... just a lone thing. You can come find it. There's no marketing or branding. And not to say that maybe down the road there won't be that. I'm fascinated with like the mechanisms behind that as well. But again, lazy.
If it helps pay the bills, it's not that you're going to get rich off of this, and most people know that. So if it just pays the bills.
Yeah, it helps keep it on its feet, keeps it going. Get those little mic clamps we were talking about beforehand.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have anything you want to promote or plug or mention before? And I can do this afterward as well.
Not really. If someone wants to help me raise money for my movie or be an investor, that would be great. Actually, wait a minute. You're legally not supposed to advertise for that. So, okay, I retract.
I can do it, though.
You can.
Sam Mondagaren is making a feature film, and he'd love you to be a part of it. So, guys... I know you've got a lot of money. Stop hoarding it and help contribute to the arts. Thanks for being here, Sam. This was fun, man. Come back again.
Thank you. I will.
All right, cool. Sam Mondagaren and delicious El Segundo beer. Pretty great experience, and I still haven't seen Pi yet. That was recorded quite a while ago, but I will watch it. I hope Sam and Kim are able to get their projects up and going, and if I hear what they're up to, I will keep you up to speed, because I hope they end up making some cool stuff. And one interesting guy to talk to. I hope the next time I bug him about being on the show, he says, "Hey man, I'm sorry, I'm too busy counting all this money from that startup we got going." So I hope that's the case, and if not, would love to have him back in again to chat anytime. What a nice guy. I feel real fortunate to be able to talk to people like that who are just so knowledgeable and friendly. Yeah, I'm traveling on a train through Switzerland. Beautiful hillside country. It's pretty nice. So let's get on out of here. Thanks to people who have reviewed the show on iTunes or subscribed and all that stuff or shared it with your friends. If you want to keep people, or not keep people, but maybe let people know what you're up to. If you want to be one of the people that gets called via Twitter, just the Twitter is space_cave. That's the best way to get involved with that. And then you can keep up with the show at thespacecave.com or me personally at davidhuntsberger.com. Now let's leave you with some music that I saw several of these songs played live in London when we did the Junk Show, which was so fun. It was a really great show in spite of like some technical difficulties, and a large part of it was because of this person, Matthew Robbins, who was one of the animators who helped with One-Headed Beast. He played keyboard and then sang, and then had a friend putting some of his, you'd have to watch or look up some of his animations to see his style, but it's very specific and very unique. And he had a friend of his put some of his little animated characters on an overhead projector, so it looked kind of like a shadow puppet show. It was incredible. And then with the music behind it as well, telling these very imaginative and just beautiful stories in the songs. Anyway, I won't overblow it too much, but Matthew Robbins is great. This is A Snake Bit My Hand off of the album Noah's Ark by Matthew Robbins. And thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.
You were looking at the crocodiles, and I was looking at you. I followed you around from cage to cage, but you never knew. Thank you. I watched you throw your nuts to the monkeys. It filled my mind with jealousy. And when you fed your buns to the elephants, I wished you would feed them to me. You sheltered from the rain in the covered reptile house, and I ran inside for shelter as well. I tried to catch your eye, but I couldn't move my arm, and my fingers had started to swell. I wanted you to love me, but a snake bit my hand. I wanted you to see me, but a snake bit my hand. And as you passed on by, and you left me lying on the sand, I wanted you to love me, but a snake bit my hand. After a while, the rain had stopped. You noticed and walked out the door. With you left my dreams, and my hopes of love lay broken next to me on the floor. I wanted you to love me, but a snake bit my hand. I wanted you to see me, but a snake bit my hand. And as you passed on by, and you left me lying on the sand, I wanted you to love me, but a snake bit my hand. Thank you.